Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And today's podcast is a really, really important one. It's an interesting, engaging, and very just disturbing in many ways issue and topic, which we've covered a lot in this podcast. But there was a new report published this week by the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission and the ESRI as well. And the study is on the area of adequate housing, and listeners will be very familiar with what we've talked about and covered around that whole question of the right to housing. And this new report has some really detailed analysis, statistics of who is affected by housing inequalities in Ireland: lone parents, people with disabilities, travellers, migrants, young people. But what's really significant, I think, is that it provides a framework of how to analyse this and how to monitor it going forward. And in this podcast today, we have a number of inputs. We have, firstly, we're joined by Sinead Gibney, who is the Chief Commissioner of the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. Then we are joined after Sinead by Louise Bayliss, who is the campaigns coordinator for Focus Ireland and also a spokesperson for Spark. And then after that, we have the new rapporteur for the United Nations on adequate housing, the right to housing. And of course, listeners as well, to this podcast will be familiar, we've had the former rapporteur for the right to housing, Leilani Farah, on a number of times. Leilani is a great friend of the podcast. And the new rapporteur is Balakrishnan Rajagopal, which I hope I've somewhat got close to how he pronounced his name. But he provided a short input to the launch of the report. And he has some really interesting points about the right to housing, monitoring it, and also calling for the moratorium on evictions to be reintroduced, which I think is quite significant. And also, I think is very significant in this is the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission call, very clear call for a rights-based approach to housing in this country, and in particular for the right to housing to be put into the constitution and obviously the referendum to be held in that. So I think that's quite important. I hope you find this podcast interesting, engaging. We know that you really value these podcasts. You know, we think they're really important. And if you can become a supporter of the Reboot Republic podcast, we are a completely independent production. Tony Groves produces them from Tortoise Shack Media. And as I said, completely independent. We have no sponsorship. So if you can become a patron supporter, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Sign up whatever you can and help us to keep going in producing these really important podcasts, the information that's here, the voices we present, and people like Sinead, Louise, and the UN Rapporteur. So thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy it.
Ní léinn tiontán mar de hiontán féin. Everyone knows that there's no place like home. The roof over our head is central to our quality of life and foundational to an equal society. We thrive physically and mentally when housing is affordable, accessible and secure, when it's free of cold, damp and disease, when it's close to work and school, and when it allows us to lead our own particular way of life. Access to adequate housing is a fundamental human right protected in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Yet, while everyone has the right to live in security, peace and dignity, inequality and discrimination are pervasive when it comes to housing in Ireland. That's why, with this new report, Monitoring Adequate Housing in Ireland, we aim to fill important gaps in our knowledge around how people live in Ireland today.
It provides a framework for monitoring progress towards the right to adequate housing. Specifically, we considered the experiences of several social groups across six areas: access to housing, housing affordability, security, cultural adequacy, housing quality and location, access to services and local environment. The groups considered cover several grounds protected in Irish equality legislation. Our research finds that lone parents, young people, migrants, people with disabilities, travellers, and others experience significant disadvantage in the Irish housing system. Less than 25% of lone parents own their own home, compared with 70% of the total population. Over 35% of the Asian population, 39% of travellers, and over 40% of the black population live in overcrowded housing, compared to just 6% in the wider population.
While national and international laws ban discrimination in housing, we believe that a further strengthening of the legal framework is needed, and that the right to adequate housing should be enshrined in the Constitution. This is ever more crucial as we recover from COVID-19 and deal with the lifting of emergency tenancy protection measures. We hope that it will spur the state to deepen its understanding of housing as a human right as it rolls out the Housing for All plan, and to fulfil its responsibility to meet international human rights standards in this area.
So now, Sinead Gibney, Chief Commissioner with the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. Sinead, what's your, I suppose, key sense of what were the most important things for you in this report that you'd like to get across to people?
I think it's about how the housing crisis is impacting different groups. I mean, that really is, for me, the most important message. And also about shifting our thinking, which I know many people are already doing and looking to do more, including your own contribution to the debate, Rory, and many others, is moving the concept of housing and how we think and treat the housing issue from units and stock towards a place where people live, with all of the complexities that we bring in our lives. And so setting out these six dimensions: accessibility, affordability, security of tenure, cultural adequacy, quality, and location. What we're trying to do is set a benchmark, a set of indicators which we can use to measure not just how many houses are being built, but the adequacy of that housing and its suitability to these specific groups. Because coming through in the findings, it is really clear that, if you like, the usual suspects, the people who are on the raw end of so many social issues and economic issues in our society, are experiencing the same when it comes to housing. So we're talking about lone parents, migrants, young people, travellers, people with a disability, migrants. So, you know, I suppose it's about understanding their specific needs, how the housing crisis is impacting on them. That's really the key piece.
And it strikes me, and it's something, you know, obviously you've done research on this throughout the crisis, the current crisis, is that these groups have been more acutely affected than others, that this housing crisis has worsened their situation. Would that be fair to say?
Yes. Yeah, I think that is fair to say. And I think it's really important for people to think about that and to bring that to people's attention. And what I'm talking about is the general population, if you like, the full population. We're all impacted by the housing crisis. It has touched all of our lives. There's no question. But it impacts us in very different ways. So for some people, it is, say for the older generation, it's about the fact that their kids are unable to secure homes and move on with their lives in the way that you would expect. So they're sometimes delaying having children, for example. They're making career choices that they would rather not, or whatever it might be. So for those, that generation, they're seeing it play out for their children and grandchildren, and they're seeing the impact from that. They're probably, in some cases, taking on additional responsibilities on behalf of their kids, both financial and practical. And then there are people who are in that cohort of younger people who are so hugely impacted, people who are, you know, either students, for example, whose educational experience is being lessened because they're having to work so much to pay for accommodation, or for young professionals who are, again, having to make career choices that might not be the optimal one because of the housing options that are available to them, and all of those different things. And then there are people for whom it is really a much more serious issue. It's about safety, security, health, and some of those basic fundamental rights that they are unable to meet because of the poor housing that they find themselves in, or the poor choices that they're being offered in terms of housing. So I think that's really important, is to understand that when we talk about the housing crisis and the problems that we're facing in housing in this country and have been facing for so long now, that people's experiences is really different. And for some people, it's a much bigger and more prominent issue in their lives. And I have to say, obviously we talk, and consultation is a big part of how we work in IREC, and obviously it's a pillar of both human rights and equality. And when I talk to different groups about their experiences around a range of issues, housing just comes up again and again and again and again. And we heard this yesterday from Karen Kiernan from One Family. She spoke on the 6-1 News and she was talking about that in terms of the service users of One Family. These are people parenting alone, and how housing is just such a prominent issue in every conversation that they have with those service users. But I would say that stretches across, from my perspective, across all of those groups that we talk to. So if you're talking about people in the international protection system, people coming through direct provision, women in situations of domestic violence, you know, all of these things are made so much more complex by the lack of housing opportunity or options available to them.
And if we look at it, how are those, because you talk about, you know, those six aspects of what, you know, the UN defines as adequate housing. And if we look at, for example, I know security and security of tenure is a fundamental one. How, you know, in your experience and what you're working in, how is that kind of affecting these different groups, and how does it affect people in terms of what you've seen and what's coming out of this report?
Well, I think, I mean, first of all, to say the six dimensions are what we have done to take, if you like, UN and international human rights standards and apply them to an Irish context. So that's the work that we did in this report with the ESRI. So they are, you know, kind of indicators that we've set in place to specifically work in the Irish context. But when we talk about security of tenure and how it impacts on those groups, I mean, if we take lone parents, for example, it's, you know, the difficulty that plays into in terms of where your children are going to school, you know, the commutes that you have to do, how you're balancing multiple jobs often. And it means that, you know, people will take poorer accommodation or poor standard of accommodation because they know that they might have that security of tenure there, if you see what I mean. So they're not able to meet all of the dimensions in the one option that they have to them. And we need all six dimensions. They're not, you know, it's not about saying, well, you have this one or that one. It's about saying, you know, the accommodation that people need should meet all of these criteria. So, you know, it's about how it affects people's lives, you know. And I spoke yesterday in some of the media outlets that I was on about my own experience of being a lone parent. And as I've acknowledged, come from a very privileged background where I did not face the same challenges and barriers that many people do in this group. But nonetheless, I was back in my own home, you know, my family home, in a single bed with my daughter for 4 years in a single room. You know, she was in a cot and then a bed. So, you know, in a situation where I should have been able to provide for her either in rental or you know, my own home. And it was only by the time she was 9 that I was able to purchase my own home. So, you know, it impacted on what I was able to look for in terms of work, where I was able to work. Because when you're a lone parent, your network is so critical. You know, when you don't have a second parent to help with childcare, many lone parents, you know, in Ireland and across the globe will lean on their own families and their own networks. So when you're forcing those, you know, families, the lone parent families, out to locations where they don't know anyone, where they don't have the same network around them to support them, it makes everything so much harder.
Yeah, no, it's really important, I think, that human story, you know, and you bringing that human story into this, because I think that's been, and you know, you started out in this, in saying that, and I heard you yesterday speaking, you know, that we need to go beyond the statistics and the figures and how many units and the human stories. And I think that is so really important, because the danger is that we just go into distraction when you just, and there's no real sense of the human cost of the crisis. You know, the toll that it's taking on people's lives. And that is so important.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, we spoke yesterday as well about the right to housing as a constitutional, you know, the efforts to enshrine that in the constitution. And one of the reasons I think that would be a very positive move is because of the debate it would prompt, you know, and because of what we would hear brought into public discourse. And, you know, and I think that, like I mentioned earlier, people's experience, their own experience of the housing crisis would then be enriched by understanding how it's impacted by everybody else. I mean, I saw herself in the cinema a couple of days ago. It's a new movie out. It's an Irish movie, a story of a woman who is fleeing domestic violence and trying to find accommodation for herself and her children. And it's a really powerful story. And I think it's powerful because it does exactly that. It, you know, obviously it's a dramatic story, but it helps you understand that behind each of those statistics is a person with so much complexities. We are not one size fits all. We all have a lot going on in our lives and a community around us. And when we reach these barriers and face them and try to overcome them, it doesn't just impact us. It impacts so many people in our lives.
And I was struck as well by you describing, the idea of you got your home, that people can't make their home in the private rental sector because of the absence of security of tenure, of affordability, and that the knock-on impacts on mental health, on development of children, on people's sense of self-esteem is destructive of their being as humans, as people, and in particular on children. It is. Do you think that how do you see that? Because in terms of for example, I know it's something that you've looked, IREC has raised, is that issue of social housing and the way in which social housing has become delivered via the private rental sector through the housing assistance payment, that this reliance on that private market leads to, problems of discrimination. Yeah. People who are vulnerable are even more exposed to, the inequalities that markets produce. And therefore, we need to be providing a greater amount of actual what we would call traditional social housing.
Yeah.
Where people don't have to compete with somebody else, and you're not up to a landlord's whim as do they like the color of your skin, do they like what you look like, as to whether you get a home or not. That really we need, that's a key solution.
Yeah, I agree. It is absolutely social housing, and how we view social housing, and just the kind of dominance of market-led solutions that we've seen in housing policy from government over the last number of years. It doesn't work. And I mean, we did see obviously housing assistance as a discriminatory ground come in a number of years ago. And that was a very positive move, but we have concerns that discrimination still happens, and it will always happen, as you said, in a private market. So I do agree that yes, there has to be social housing that is provided for people with that in mind. And I think you come up against, this, I suppose it's part of a bigger shift of a move from the acceptance of a welfare state and the idea that people have an entitlement to certain things. And I think we have shifted away from that as a society in many, many countries towards a place where everything has to be earned, that you have to work hard for things. But I think it fails to accept the reality of the situation for many people. Like you've talked about for example, the knock-on effects of living in substandard housing. And I would say for forlorn parents, if we go back to that group again, there is a stigma in Irish society. There is a, in many, many ways, people just accept that non-traditional families are inferior. I mean, that's in our constitution. That's in 43.1, if you like, because it describes the married unit as being the primary way in which families should be based upon. So, there is this acceptance, I think, for within a lot of people that diversity of family shape, if you like, is not the ideal. So you have that stigma. Then we have a situation where those families are presented with barriers from day one in just simply living, in just simply making decisions. And they don't get the same opportunities as everybody else because they don't have the cooking facilities, for example, in a hotel to cook the right food for their children. Their children don't have the opportunities for after school activities that they otherwise might. They don't become the Olympians they could become because they haven't got the training facility. Do you know, like all of those barriers are just put up, so they don't get to realize. So then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where we're saying, well, you're not good enough. Here's what society is going to offer you, a short straw, and then you don't fulfill your potential. It's not a surprise to me that happens, and that's just one group. And I think it happens in many, many groups where I feel like I've ranted now and got off the point a little from your original question.
No. I think it feeds in to, the societal discrimination and stigma feeds into what people expect of themselves, what they believe they can do. And this idea that, we're all starting out equal and it's those who work hard will get, to the people who work hard. The idea of the meritocracy is complete nonsense when you've people growing up in a hotel room or a family hub or, on a halting site where they've no running water, or they're starting from a completely different place. And as children, I think what's very significant, and the development of, you know, psychology in particular, I think is really interesting around the whole concept of, we talk about adverse childhood experiences and and the stress and the impact of stress on the development of the brain, the child's brain. And, you know, we're realizing, and, you know, people realize it for a long time, but increasingly understanding the effects of poverty, of stress, of inequality on children from the moment they're born makes them so much more disadvantaged and stops them developing. And therefore, this idea that somehow it's their fault is utter wrong, is complete nonsense and wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, I think it's a real issue. And I think that the reason why I would support the referendum on enshrining the right to housing in our constitution is exactly that, that it allows us to talk about these things and it allows us to bring that into to the public arena. You know, I've said this before, I think, you know, in my role, I suppose the way I see it is exactly as you've just described. You know, if I'm born into a traveller halting site, my outcomes immediately on health, education, employment, mental health, you know, housing,
life expectancy,
like the very starkest of statistics, they are all just cut short compared to somebody who is born into a house, you know, a street nearby, you know, and that's not okay. And it won't be okay. You know, I really do feel that for me is the driving force behind what I do in my role. And I suppose, you know, what I've tried to pursue in my career, which is about dismantling these, you know, systemic inequalities that we see in society and the disadvantage that springs from it. So, yeah, it's a huge one. And it is, you know, there's policy. There's policy decisions and policymakers who are, you know, responsible for, you know, if you like, the state is responsible for how some of this has manifested. But it is also about us as a society. It is also about public perception, public ideology. And, you know, if we do have the public will to change this, that will then move the political will. You know, in ending homelessness by 2030, as we've, you know, as a state, we've signed up to that now. You know, and for me, that's too far away personally into the future. But of course, it's great that it's, you know, a commitment in and of itself. And it can be done. And we've seen that. We heard from the special rapporteur. He was citing Finland as an example now of where it's all but eradicated homelessness. And we have that choice as a society. We can be a society that tolerates deprivation, poverty, disadvantage, or we can be a society that doesn't tolerate it. And that's what I want to work towards.
Absolutely. No, and I think so many people, and I know our listeners, and so many people across this country, that is the society and that is the country they want. And, you know, we see from opinion polls that, you know, IREC have commissioned that, you know, the majority of people want to see the right to housing put on in the constitution, for example. And just on that to finish, how do you see do you see a role, or what role would IREC play in progressing that referendum for a right to housing? Because, you know, it's been called for and you've called it before. But, you know, and there's obviously commitments within the programme for government for a referendum. It's been reasserted in Housing for All. It hasn't been explicit about the right to housing, which is concerning. But how do you see IREC's role in progressing that, in us achieving that referendum and to insert the right to housing in the constitution?
Well, I mean, as you know, we've already declared our position that we believe that it is an appropriate thing to do, and we've encouraged the government to do it. We are, as a commission, looking at the broader picture of economic and social rights in the constitution at the moment. We're also at a point where we are setting in place our strategy for the next 3 years. So beyond that, to be honest, I don't have clarity yet on exactly what role we play. There's a huge community of people who are contributing to this, and you know, some of the law centres, legal academics, who've done some really great work on the analysis around this and the understanding around it. And I think some of the important lines that I was kind of feeding into the media yesterday was around just trying to first and foremost kind of eradicate or dismantle this myth that enshrining the right to housing in the constitution means that the government will be obliged, that the state will be obliged to build a home for every single individual. That's just not the case. That's not what it does. What it does is provide measures to prevent homelessness, to provide adequacy of housing, to look at the most vulnerable in our society and make sure that they are taken care of in their housing needs. And I personally think that is needed. I mean, you know, you referenced earlier about the security of tenure issues. I mean, we have a very specific cultural attitude towards land ownership, towards property ownership, towards rental, renting as a way of life in this country. And, you know, I think if we were to look at those protections being embedded into the constitution, it would help with the development of that culture, because we are a modern society with a culturally diverse population, and we have now different attitudes towards home ownership, rental, long-term rental, and so on. So we have to deal with that reality. And for me, I think as the National Human Rights Institution and the National Equality Body, we will be doing all we can to drive this debate and looking at ways that we can advance it. So I suppose I don't have anything more specific than that to add, but suffice to say that it's definitely high on our radar.
Yeah, no, I think it's so important to. For me, it's absolutely fundamental, that referendum. And people are saying, oh, well, sure, wouldn't build one home. But I think that's not true, because in what you're talking about there, the changing of the attitudes, and I think it is really important to put that obligation on the state that, it does actually ensure everybody has their right to housing fulfilled. And it does that through lots of different ways, because I think that's part of the problem, that the state has just shirked and abdicated and not taken on its responsibilities. So for me, it is very fundamental. And just maybe last question, I'll try to push you a little bit. Would you put a time frame? Would you put a time frame on when it's reasonable for the government to hold a referendum? In my view, I don't see why they can't hold it in the next 6 months. But would you put a time frame?
I don't worry. I mean, as you know, we're a 50-member commission. For me to come out with something like that, I'd have to consult with my colleagues. But I do think that it's problematic that the programme for government commitment, as you've said, is somewhat weak, and it's dependent on the establishment of a housing commission. So yeah. I do think that's problematic. I also appreciate that there are many, many different there's a queue essentially of referenda, if you like, or topics that are up for potential referendums, including the gender clause in 41.2. So I appreciate kind of acknowledge the government's position that there are many things that they're dealing with. So it is in the mix with all of that, and obviously we nearly did have that referendum a couple of years ago. So I suspect that will be the next one in the queue, if you like. They can only have so many.
Yeah. Okay.
I know that's not what you want to hear, but there you go.
Well, listen, Sinead, it's been wonderful to have you on.
Thanks, Rory.
And appreciate all the work that you do and the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission do. I think it's really vital and fundamental work to empower the groups that are being excluded and continue that agenda and talk about equality and rights and get that conversation. So thank you for joining me today in Reboot and for your work you do.
Thanks so much, Rory.
And now I'm joined by Louise Bayliss, who is campaigns coordinator for Focus Ireland and also spokesperson for Spark. Louise, what is your reaction to the report?
The report is shocking, but not surprising. There's nothing in it that I wouldn't have expected. We've been seeing it on the ground for years. And we know why lone parents are suffering. And obviously, housing is a symptom of that. I mean, all the reports that have gone to date, no, we know what's needed for lone parents. We need affordable quality childcare. We need affordable good quality housing, step two. We need, family friendly, working payment jobs. We don't have that either. And then the fourth one would be a robust statutory maintenance agency. And again, we don't have a maintenance agency. We have court orders that the person who gets the money has to try to enforce, which is practically impossible. So the four pillars that would make life easier for lone parents, we are failing hugely in all of them. I mean, the National Childcare Scheme really had a negative impact on lone parents with school-aged children, because it eliminated the targeted schemes that were specifically there to allow lone parents access to education, training and employment. Those schemes are gone now, and we've got the universal payment. That has made a huge impact on the subsidies available for lone parents for after school care. So the situation has deteriorated. Housing, as we know, has deteriorated. Maintenance, even the way maintenance is assessed. I mean, one of the things is that there's a housing income disregard as part of maintenance. So if somebody's paying a mortgage or if they're paying towards their children, there's a housing income disregard. That housing income disregard was £75 back in 1997. It has not changed since 1997, and it's now €95.23. Now, at the same time, the IREC report highlighted that rents have gone up in Dublin by 40% in 2016 to 2021, yet we have a housing income disregard that the Department of Social Protection are using that was set 24 years ago.
Yeah, it seems to me that we have an issue whereby I get to the point now, and it was Tricia Keelty highlighted there that this is the ninth report since 2016 highlighting the challenges, the discrimination, the inequalities faced by one parent families. And I was thinking about it and going, is there an acceptable level of poverty and discrimination that this state has decided in regard to lone parents? Do you feel that? Do you think, if you look at it, is there just an acceptance? Well, you know, that's just the situation that we really can't.
There seems to be this idea, well, you can't expect a one-income family to compete with a two-income family. So, hey, that's just the way it is. And that just seems so wrong that children's lives are going to be impacted by the relationship status of their parents. And especially when we have the solutions, we know that that's what would work. We know we need affordable childcare. We know we need, I mean, if yes, we're competing with one income, but so why don't we have a statutory maintenance agency that provides an income for the child and makes life easier for the child and the parent raising the child? We know the solutions. And as you said, Tricia Keelty from Vincent de Paul, she's very clear. The reports are there. The solutions are there. There's a lack of political, of probably societal will. And even yesterday when the report came out, there was an awful lot of talk about people going, well, they made their choices, and all of this nasty rhetoric and nasty narrative. And you go, you know what, I can see how the Magdalene laundries existed, because it's in the DNA of some people that were commenting yesterday, that judgment that, well, you made your choices aren't life. If only life was so simple that you make a choice at 25 and you're on that trajectory for the rest of your life, if other things didn't influence you, and regardless of, even if you take out that, which obviously I wouldn't, because I think everybody deserves support in society, but children born in lone parent families or children who become part of a lone parent family through abuse or domestic violence or through death or widowhood, for whatever reason, all of our families deserve support. And that's why in Spark, you would never differentiate between how you got into becoming a lone parent, whether it was you were never married, you're divorced, whether you're widowed. We are still all living the same reality, trying to raise children on our own and trying to do it unlimited means. And to be fair, Focus Ireland have recognised that lone parents are such an important group within homelessness. And last year we became part of the National One Parent Family Alliance, and we've been working really proactively to trying to change the living conditions of lone parents through the National One Parent Family Alliance. And it's been a really powerful alliance that was set up in COVID. It's one good thing to come out of COVID. And it includes the likes of Barnardo's, Children's Rights Alliance, One Family, Truer, FLAC, Spark, Focus Ireland, St. Vincent de Paul, I hope I haven't forgotten anybody, but a really powerful group who are committed to making material changes in the life of lone parents. But we're facing the lack of political will.
And as you say, still the lack of political will and societal prejudice and judgments, which is still there. And I was struck by that as well, that, you know, we're claiming and we say we're a progressive society and tolerant and open, and we've made such changes, positive, progressive changes. And yet when it comes to lone parents, there is such backward, you know, negative perceptions. Why do you think that's persisting?
No, I really don't know. I mean, when we saw, yes, equality for, you know, same-sex marriages, it seemed to be a really threshold moment for the country that we were accepting all families. And it hasn't happened. You know, lone parent families aren't accepted. And there is something strange in that lone parent families, if they're unmarried, they're not even recognised in the constitution. So two adults can marry and have no children, and they're recognised by the state as a family. But a mother and a child, or a father and a child, aren't recognised as a family. And that has to change. And it really came home to me recently when a friend of mine who's a lone parent had to sign a family home declaration, you know, to buy her first property. And when she had to sign, she had to state a legal declaration saying, this is not a family home. And she was really, really hurt by it, because this is her family. Her daughter is her family. And to have to sign a legal declaration that this is not a family home. Now, I understand why it's about, but words matter. And that type of thing that we've just accepted, that even the state's paperwork and legalities say we're not a legal family, that's hurtful.
Yeah, and it's interesting because society, you know, people go on about, oh, you know, the society, you know, and you've got people just saying this, and, you know, politicians are trying their best and government is trying their best to, you know, change that. But yet when you look at the housing discussion, and in particular, I was very struck by the use of wording around the investment fund, the policy measures that were put in place to respond to the investment funds, where they referred to the housing. I think the language was, when they introduced the new stamp duty measure that would stop investor funds buying up houses, bulk buying houses, that they used the phrase traditional family homes. And they might have even used normal family. There was definitely traditional family homes was used. And I was so struck by that. So what? The only people who are worthy of protection from investor funds are two couple families with children.
It is breathtaking when you see it like that. There is something, and I don't know what it is, but there's something in the DNA of Irish people that just really does not accept lone parents. And it's why Magdalen Laundrie's thrived. And I am not for one instance trying to say we're back in those times, but the attitudes still prevail. And it's, as you said, at the opening start of this conversation, there seems to be an acceptable level of poverty and deprivation that is acceptable. And it's okay for some children to live in that deprivation. And I can't understand it. And I don't want to understand it, to be honest. I don't want to have that mentality.
No, it absolutely has to change. And I think that, I suppose, it's the importance of, you know, having this conversation, the importance of the report itself, the coverage for it, and highlighting the structural reasons why, you know, the majority of homeless families are lone parents is because of the housing system and the way in which we've changed to rely on the HAP and the private rental sector, not because of lone parents themselves.
Yeah, I was struck by a piece on RTE yesterday where there was a very educated lone parent. She had a master's degree. She had a very responsible job, but she needed HAP for housing, which, you know, on one income, that makes 100% sense. And she said that when she was going to view HAP as a lone parent, she felt the stigma, and she felt she was competing against two parents, and that she would dress up to go to the viewings and felt it was like a job interview, that she had to prove herself. And so many lone parents say, it's part of what we talk about in the group, having to prove yourself that you're not the stereotype of the lone parent. And that seems really wrong, because what is the stereotype? And the amount of people who then say, oh, well, you're not what I mean. Well, who do you mean? Do you know? Because there's this image of what a lone parent is. And the reality is, most lone parents are responsible raising their children. Why are we not... why is that stigma and shame not going to the parent who walked away? Why is it in the hands of the parent who's responsible and trying to raise a child against insurmountable barriers?
And absolutely. And the state, you know, and we still don't, you know, as you say, in regards to maintenance, you know, put that co-responsibility there on the other parent. But also, I think, why do we not put the shame back on the state and back on,
absolutely,
you know, the policies that are creating, you know, such inequalities? And why do we, you know, structure our housing system and our economic system and our welfare system so that, as you say, we discriminate against these children just because they're from lone parent families? It's something, you know, that is still deeply wrong in this country. And I think it is one of the key equality issues that remains to be addressed.
Yeah, I couldn't With you, Rory. And while I am disheartened that, as Tricia Kilty said, we're on our ninth report in how many years, I do hope this report gives us some traction. And I do hope that it'll be a tool that will wake up politicians and the general public that it is not right to see to treat certain children this way. And to be honest, it's a feminist issue as well. Like 86% of lone parents are headed by a woman. And you'd wonder, you know, if this was the opposite way, would lone parents be treated in the same manner as they are now? If it was 86% male, would policies be designed to support the families?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really fair point. Louise Bayliss, campaigns coordinator for Focus Ireland and also spokesperson for Spark. Thank you so much for joining us again on Reboot Republic. It's always lovely to have you on.
Lovely. Thanks, Rory.
Dear Chief Commissioner Sinéad Gibney, dear Mr. Barrett, honourable participants, dear friends, it is a pleasure for me to speak at this event, launching the report of the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission and the Economic and Social Research Institute on monitoring adequate housing. Let me first and foremost express, as UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing, my gratitude to the Human Rights and Equality Commission and the research team of ESRI for their outstanding report. I would be pleased if other national human rights institutions would undertake similar important research and monitoring of the right to adequate housing. This report is based on the definition of the right to adequate housing in international human rights law and presents a corresponding set of indicators for monitoring the realization of the right to adequate housing in Ireland. Like in several other advanced economies, many people in Ireland live in adequate housing. We should all be thankful for this, but just monitoring housing data for the entire population would hide serious housing rights issues and concerns that still many people face in Ireland. I'm therefore pleased that this report analyzes, as far as official disaggregated data is available, how the right to adequate housing is enjoyed by different social groups, including marginalized groups. The report concludes that there is a need to improve data collection on the right to adequate housing by people from different ethnic backgrounds, religion, gender identity, and sexual orientation. It highlights that there is insufficient data on people living in homelessness, caravans, or in various institutional settings, like persons living in care homes, hospitals, prisons, accommodation centers for refugees, and asylum centers, seekers, as national survey data does not capture the actual housing situation of people in such settings. I can only call on the Irish authorities and the National Statistical Office to fill this gap. As far as homelessness is concerned, it should be noted that the European Parliament Social Affairs Committee voted some weeks ago in favor of an amendment to the EU budget 2022, allowing for a €1 million euro pilot project on data collection on homelessness throughout Europe. I hope that Budget Committee of the European Parliament will as well approve this. We need better, regular, comprehensive, and more comparable data on homelessness in Ireland and in many other countries in Europe. The same applies to evictions and their prevention, which remains a global phenomenon, or the enjoyment of the right to adequate housing of LGBTI persons, in particular LGBTI youth. The report notes that there is not much data on whether current institutional legal frameworks actually prevent adequately discrimination in the field of housing, including against homeless people. This is very important, especially in the light of the judgment of the European Court of Human Rights recently in Lacatus versus Switzerland. Secondly, we also do not know fully if victims of housing discrimination are able to receive timely and effective relief. Research conducted by the Fundamental Rights Agency of Europe and academics concerning travelers and persons of African descent suggests so. If you're a traveler, have a foreign surname, look non-European, the chances to get a rental contract you applied for to get credit or a mortgage for buying housing are reduced. I was quite shocked that this report reveals that one group, single or lone parent households, appears to be particularly disadvantaged on nearly all housing rights dimensions assessed by this report. Single parents and their children account for 53% of all homeless families and are much more likely to experience poor housing than other households, and they face nearly four times as frequently compared to the general population affordability problems. Nearly half of them have to rely on the rental market for housing, compared to only 20% of the general population. They are the most impoverished and face more significantly, more often, arrears in paying for their housing costs, and are among those with the lowest security of tenure and highest risk of evictions. They're also more likely to live in substandard housing with low quality. This raises a fundamental question. How can we as a society be actually treating single parents and their children? We speak here not about a few individuals. One out of five persons in Ireland lives in a single parent household, and 86% of lone parents in Ireland are women. We all have to therefore ask ourselves, how are we ensuring that everyone has equal access to safe and adequate home? If we are not serious about ending gender discrimination, if we want to end discrimination of children who just happen to grow up with their mother or father, then you must act, and act now. This is just one of the more concerning findings of this excellent study. This report provides data on what is close to my heart. We need to be more serious about ending housing discrimination and curb as well the adverse impact of spatial segregation on various human rights, including the right to adequate housing, education, healthcare, and equal access to public services. Dear ladies and gentlemen, an important step to ensure that the right to adequate housing can be relied on in courts and before public administration and entities would be to enshrine this right in the Irish Constitution, as many other countries have done. I therefore can only fully support this recommendation made by the Chief Commissioner. It would also be an important step towards implementing a core recommendation contained in the UN guidelines for the implementation of the right to adequate housing. The research and data on which this study is based has been largely collected before or at the time of the COVID-19 pandemic. I am pleased that the Irish government tried to protect mortgage payers and tenants in rented accommodation by imposing temporary measures to prevent a large wave of evictions. Responding to my call as UN Special Rapporteur for a global moratorium on evictions during the pandemic. However, the pandemic is not over, and one of my deepest concerns is what happens now after these temporary measures have been lifted. How can we ensure that we do not see a massive wave of evictions in Ireland, Europe, the US, and many other states? How can we prevent a further increase of homelessness, which is one of the most severe violations of the right to adequate housing? How can we prevent a crisis from becoming a catastrophe? Let me conclude by referring to the Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations that have also been endorsed by the government of Ireland. One of the SDG targets specifies that everyone should have access to a safe and adequate housing by 2030. I believe this is possible, in particular in a relatively prosperous society such as Ireland. Let us therefore do the utmost to prevent any new wave of evictions. And ladies and gentlemen, let us be serious to end homelessness. It is possible to do so. Homelessness can be radically reduced, at least to marginal proportions, as Finland, another European country, has shown recently, if there is political will to do so. Many thanks. I wish you all a nice afternoon and fruitful deliberations.
That was really powerful there from the new UN Rapporteur on Adequate Housing. We also heard from Sinead Gibney from the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission and Louise Bayliss. I think what comes to my mind hearing them is the lack of action from the Irish state and its acceptance, as I was talking to Louise in particular, the acceptance of inequality, exclusion amongst groups in society who are marginalized, who are vulnerable. And I think we still have a real job to actually get our state to accept responsibility for us to talk in society, talk with those around us and say, this is not acceptable. This is not the country we want. And so we have to keep that conversation going. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the conversations that you will have. And if you can, support us to keep going, keep producing these podcasts. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, become a supporter. And let's keep the conversation moving towards that republic of equality whereby we wouldn't have these type of reports. We would be producing reports like they do in Finland, where they're producing reports showing how they are going to end homelessness and how they're ending discrimination and the achievements we're making. That's the country where we're going to get to. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you all soon.